I'm Bree Mulder, and I am a student worker at the Women's Center. I'd like to welcome you to our Spring 2012 Women on Wednesday series, Exploring and Making Visible Women's Intersecting Identities. This semester's series on women's intersecting identities will explore the rich layers of women's multiple identities and how these intersections shape their lived experiences and perceptions. A few items before we get started. Please turn off your cell phones and please stay seated until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speakers. If you could also please fill out the evaluation form, we use your feedback for future programming. Our session today is titled Religious Traditions and Gender. Our panelists will discuss the ways that religion from various spiritual traditions shape and give meaning and challenge to women's lived experiences. Our panelists today are Phyllis Greenberg, Myron Omar, and the Reverend Jane M. Thompson. Phyllis Greenberg, PhD, is an associate professor and coordinator of graduate studies in gerontology at SCSU. Greenberg guest lectures on issues related to anti-Semitism, older women, diversity, policy, and social justice. Myron Omar was born and raised in Somalia with a Muslim upbringing. She studied the Quran, the Hadith, and many of the Islamic scholarly books, as well as the Bible and the Torah of Christian and Jewish faiths. She is the cultural outreach specialist for Centricare, helping to educate Somali women about birth and pregnancy. The Reverend Jane M. Thompson serves as the campus congregation pastor at the University Lutheran Church of the Epiphany and the Lutheran Campus Ministry of the ELCA. Ordained in 1983, she has served congregations and campus ministries with a passion for young adults, justice, and for all people, and interfaith conversations that bring people of faith together. We are very grateful to have them here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Phyllis Greenberg, Myron Omar, and the Reverend Jane M. Thompson.
I think one of the things that we decided that we would do is that each one of us in turn would tell a little bit about our story and our experience, deciding that we are not representing everybody who's from the same faith background that we are, because everybody's going to have different experiences. Geography makes it different. Generationally, it can be different. So we thought that we would add a personal touch to that and tell you our own stories of being women and being parts of faith communities. Mm-hmm. So because I guess I'm already starting talking, we will go in order, right? That I will start out. I am originally from New York. And when people ask me what part of New York, that tells a New Yorker you're not from New York. Because when you say you are from New York, there's only one place that could possibly be, and that would be New York City. Mm-hmm. And I said that I didn't live there for too long, but I went from what would arguably be the most diverse place, not just in the United States, but one of the most diverse places in the world, to moving across the country and growing up in Southern California. Not particularly diverse. I also went to many different schools, which I think made a difference on the experiences that I had. I went to 5 different elementary schools, 3 different junior highs, and 2 different high schools. Generally, the only time there was another Jewish kid in one of the schools I went to is if one of my siblings, and luckily I have a fairly large family, happened to be in the same school that I was at. Leaving New York, we were just talking about this, we met earlier, that if I had stayed in New York City, I do think my experience would have been very different. Because there's lots of everybody there, you don't stand out, right? You know that you can turn around and you can see other people that resemble you, that there's community with you almost no matter where you go. Since I've moved from York, that has not been the case. Certainly, I'll talk a little bit about my experiences in Minnesota, but I've also lived in Washington State and went to graduate school in rural Virginia, which was maybe one of the most life-changing experiences because it's what I decided to do my dissertation on. And my dissertation is about how people develop a sense of identity, a sense of self, and in particular looking at Jewish feminist women living in rural areas or areas that are maybe much more Christian-centric, and particularly there, which would be primarily a little bit more evangelical, Christian-centric, Baptist, Christian-centric, which, as Jane will talk about, there are very different things there. That just because you might use a label doesn't mean that you know everything about that person based on what they say. I have been dealing with stuff about not being part of the dominant culture my entire life, and I think that helps define and form who you are. In schools, when I was in school, everything very, 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 very religious and specific, Christmas programming, and so there'd be all these different things going on, which I didn't want to participate in because it just really had no meaning to me. And in second grade was the first time it really sort of new school and sort of had some issues when everybody was getting up to sing Christmas songs. I don't mind a little jingle bells here and there. I can certainly join in with that. But when it started being religious songs, I didn't know them. And secondly, it somehow seemed wrong to me. I had it in my mind that if I put the words Jesus and Christ together, that something bad might happen. Those are certainly not terms or words that I would use, and certainly with any belief system involved in that. But I was taught to be very polite, and they started singing, they did the jingle bells and a few other more innocuous songs, and then they started to sing, as I tell people, the song to this day that can just send a shiver up and down my spine. They started singing Away in the Manger. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's a beautiful song, but it is an odd song for people in second grade to be singing. Opera singers sing Away in the Manger. So they started singing, and I just stood there very nicely, not smirking, as I've been told sometimes I can do, just standing there very nicely. Teacher made everybody stop. Of course, for all I know, this is part of the song. I don't know, maybe they stop in the middle of the song. And so I'm looking around, everybody else is looking around, and she's looking at me. Now, for those of you who are in class, especially think about your elementary school years, junior high, and high school, generally when this class has been stopped and somebody's looking at you, not always a good thing. So I'm just looking around, and she goes, Phyllis, I'm certainly the only Phyllis in the classroom, why aren't you singing? Well, you know, I'm not going to tell her you're all of a sudden everybody's looking at you. And so she figured, all right, got over it. Had everybody start singing again. I wasn't singing. She made everybody stop. Of course, now it was obvious everybody was going to stare at me. And she goes, if Phyllis isn't going to sing, nobody gets to sing. Now, first, let me just say, if you had ever heard me sing, nobody has ever requested that I actually sing. Usually, like, you take choir and all that, it's just like, would you like to turn the pages for the accompanist? Or maybe you could just mouth the words. So that was shocking, and I'm going, and everybody's staring at me. It's like, it's either, if we're not singing, we're going to do arithmetic. Singing, arithmetic. So I wouldn't do, we don't work well in my family with ultimatums, because now even if I wanted to do it, not happening. So she called me insubordinate, a word I'd never heard before, and sent me to the principal's office. I'll have to tell you that nearly every year of my life in elementary school, at Christmas time, I got sent to the principal's office. For one thing, I went to so many different schools, but it just became, I was just ready. Would you like me just to go ahead? Let's just cut out all the middle stuff, and I'll just go to the principal's office, because I did not want to participate in Christmas things. Like I said, really no meaning to me, and it seemed it seemed kind of disrespectful in some ways for me to participate in something that, at least at that time, I thought might have been very sacred and very special to other people. Every year, one year, you know, they're going to make Christmas cards, and I just made up my own mind, because after a while, I just stopped asking, and I just thought, I'm going to make a Hanukkah card for my parents. You're supposed to make cards for your parents, and the teacher came by and looked at me, and I do a lot of work with people who are going to be new teachers, because I think, let's think about the pedagogy here. This is how not to be an effective and good teacher. She goes, so what are you doing there? And I said, I'm making a Hanukkah card, and which I'm sure in her mind is, I just said, I'm making a blah, blah, blah. Had no meaning to her. And she goes, well, today's assignment, the activity for today, is Christmas cards for your parents. But I don't want to give a Christmas card to my parents. We're making Christmas cards, but I'm not making a Christmas card. And I got a little bit hysterical and got sent to the principal's office. Sometimes around Easter, I would get sent to the principal's office. The only off-schedule event, because there's something about making people feel like they don't belong, and I think that's one of the things I've gotten so involved in, is I believe it was fifth grade or sixth grade. There was a student who was a Jehovah's Witness, and they don't say a Pledge of Allegiance, right? Because there's a lot of things looking at putting country before God. And so he, too, was raised to be very polite. Teacher made him, everybody stop because he wasn't saying the Pledge of Allegiance. And he asked him why, and not in a very kind way. And, of course, you feel embarrassed because now everybody's looking at you. If you didn't already feel different, let me just point out to you, right, how different you might be. He started crying and left. The next day, everybody stood up to say the Pledge of Allegiance, and I decided not to say the Pledge of Allegiance. So he made everybody stop, and I thought, like, I've been doing this for the last 8 years. You're not going to make me cry, and I don't like to see other people cry. And he says, why are you doing? I said, well, one, you can't make me, which always goes over really well. And I just said, if it makes people cry, it's not worth it. Plus, I always thought it was an odd thing because people would, like, look to the corner of a wall. And I grew up in San Diego. There wasn't even a flag there. You'd think of all places, San Diego. Big military town, there'd be that. So it's just looking at not just my own experience, but other people. I mean, have had issues, people trying to convert me, and certainly did not go over well because there were so few other Jewish people in the schools that I went to. And I was certainly very out and open about that. And I did not look like everybody else. A lot of people thought I was Chicana. People thought I was this. As I'd say, sometimes that works really well when there's riots, is that sometimes people don't know if they're supposed to hug you or slug you. They don't know what group you belong to. On the other hand, it can go against you as well. I've lived in a variety of different places. Coming to Minnesota, I'll just kind of sum up with that in my story, and thinking that I experienced everything, and I grew up, my father was very passionate about Hubert Humphrey and all these different things about Minnesota, and so I was really excited. I will have to say for the first 3 or 4 years that I lived here, it was extremely challenging. Not because, I mean, I have very good friends, knowing Jane and knowing a lot of other people, but because of assumptions that people made. One, about if you were Jewish. Two, that everybody celebrates the same holidays or you shouldn't mind, and just talking about holidays. Not acknowledging that people eat different foods for different reasons, or that wing of people dress or whatever. And until lately, whether you see a lot more change in Minnesota, I have to tell you, I often thought for the first few years that I lived here that I would leave, except for getting to know a lot of people and all that, because there is that sense of Minnesota nice, which sometimes is on the surface. And it's very similar to in the South, where people will say hello to you, but they never open their door. And I think there is a similarity in Minnesota because people might be used to everybody looking alike and everybody doing things alike. And I always, which I won't take time, but I mean, just do stories about hair in and of itself, and coming to Minnesota and looking around, I'm thinking like, oh no, this isn't going to work. And trying to find, what are we going to do about this? And looking around and not being able to see anybody. And there is that thing, you usually want to find people who look like you or have some similarities to you. And it took me a lot longer here than other places. But now we have a community, we have a pretty vibrant Jewish community here, as well as just a community of people who are supportive and wanting to interact. Doesn't mean that we still don't have issues. Every place has issues. I think what defines a community, what defines a place, is how we react to those issues and how we support people who may be feeling marginalized. So I'll stop there and turn that over to
me.
To you.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Phyllis. As we met before and sat together at the Caribou Coffee, we shared some stories. We know parts of our stories together, but we thought as women it would be important to ground our conversation in the stories of our lives, our faith stories, and our spirituality. And that may be different than perhaps either you expected or that you've heard in other interfaith conversations, where it's a conversation about books and theology or ideas, and certainly we have thoughts and brains and have studied theology, but for us as women, the grounding of our story in our families, in our journeys, where we've lived, traveled from Somalia to the United States, these things are very important to us. I've been doing interfaith conversations most of my life, as I can recall, beginning at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and even in my high school in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I was born and baptized a Lutheran, and one of my students at Kansas State University said, "You're a Lutheran to the max." And my heritage is of Norwegian descent, and also then English, Welsh, and French. But I know the Norwegian side of my family very well. My mother's family is from Norway, and the Scandinavian part of me is very strong. In all of our holiday traditions, it was very much a Scandinavian and a Norwegian understanding of our Lutheran heritage. I don't do lutefisk. My grandmother, she said ishkafida, that she would never make lutefisk. When I grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, I just remember as a small child, wherever I was, I loved going to church. I loved Sunday school. I loved singing. I do like singing, and have been in choirs, so I'm sorry that they treated you that way. That makes me really sad. I love the stories of Jesus, and as I grew up and became a teenager, I looked at what the pastor was doing at my home church in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and I thought, I could do that. And at that time, they were not ordaining women in the Lutheran church. At that time, it was the American Lutheran Church, which is more the Norwegian part of the Lutheran church, which has since merged into what is now the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, of which I am a member and a rostered ordained woman. When I was at my church in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, I asked to be the first girl acolyte. Now, some of you, if you've been an acolyte, you might think, well, that seems like a no-brainer. But in my time, girls couldn't be acolytes. And I thought, I can do that. And I told the pastor I wanted to be an acolyte, and he just stared at me. And then he walked away. This wouldn't be the first time he would do that. I said other things that caused him to stare at me and then just walk away in disbelief. But I asked to be one. I wanted to wear that red cassock and then the white surplice over that, and I wanted to have the acolyte staff, and I wanted to light all the six candles on the altar as they radiated out from the cross. This was something that caused great consternation at Our Savior Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. They had to take it to the church council. The church council was made up of all men, and my dad was on the council. I didn't know that at the time. I was 12. They brought this up as an agenda item, and they talked about it for over an hour, whether I could be a girl acolyte. Again, this is not known to me until much later. My father told me this when I was, I think, in seminary. They said I could be one. And I think now it was because they didn't have enough boys, and also because they couldn't say no because my dad was on the council, which is a good thing. My dad has always been an advocate for his three daughters to do whatever they believed in, whatever they were called to do, and supported us to do whatever it was in school or in sports or in our studies. So I got to be the first girl acolyte, and I was very proud on that day. And my mother made me wear patent leather shoes and dress up, and I think she made me curl my hair. I didn't want to, but I had to. And I guess for the boys, it was a thing that they had to do, but it was something I got to do. And I was so happy that I got to do that. I didn't know at the time that, again, it was causing people in the congregation to be aghast or anything. I didn't think there was anything wrong about it. It would be then later, and when I was in confirmation, which I did like confirmation, even though it was sort of boring, I liked to ask the pastor hard questions. And I guess that probably annoyed them as well. I then, as I was watching worship and going to church, I could memorize the pastor's pardon. If you happen to be of the Christian tradition and a liturgical church, the pastor sings, and I would memorize that and sing it under my breath. the communion part. And I wasn't supposed to do that. But I did it under my breath anyway because I decided I wanted to be a pastor. So again, I went to tell that same pastor, Pastor Hilker, when I was in confirmation. I said, I would like to be a pastor. And again, he just stared at me. I said, we have a Sons of the Ministry Fund here at Our Savior Lutheran Church, and one day you're going to change that to Sons and Daughters of the Ministry. And then he walked away. Again, I didn't know that I could be a pastor. I just thought I wanted to do that because I believe that God was calling me in my spirit and who I am to do this. And later on, I would act on that call, but that would be much later. I went to Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. It's a college of the church. And I really wanted to be a veterinarian at this time because I had put that other idea behind me. I loved biology, and I really liked animals. I still love animals to this day. I have two salamanders at my house. People make fun of me because I've always been a person to notice animals that are hurt or injured and then try and take care of them. So I went to Luther College thinking I'd be a veterinarian. I was in biology. I didn't like chemistry very much. So I switched to religion and psychology, and I loved that. It was wonderful for me. And in my church growing up, it wasn't that we were told women, you know, absolutely couldn't do these things. It's just there weren't any women doing the things that I wanted to do. So it wasn't sort of a strident prohibition. It was just sort of Iowa nice, or just an unspoken thing that women just don't do these things. But at Luther College, my first year there, there was a woman. She was from Yale University. Her name was Nan Herleman. She was a very slight woman with sort of strawberry blonde hair, and I remember her preaching in the chapel. I had never seen anybody do that. And she preached a wonderful homily about a party and Jesus and a welcome. And that's all I remembered. But I thought, here's somebody who is doing what I thought I had told my pastor I wanted to do back when I was a teenager. I continued my religion and psychology major, and I had a wonderful faculty member, Richard Simon Hansen, who is Norwegian and Lutheran. He speaks fluent Hebrew. He teaches the Hebrew Testament, and I love that class. He would dance and sing and speak to us in Hebrew, and I just delighted and just relished that class. And he and I had deep theological conversations about Jesus and about Judaism and faith communities, and he asked me hard questions about what it means to be a Christian and how is it that I'm to live the love of Jesus in the world. Does that mean that all other religions are excluded? And he asked me those deep probing questions that as a religion major I had to think about. I continued on and was going to go maybe be a clinical psychologist or, I don't know, something. But my professor, Richard Simon Hansen, said to me, you really need to go to seminary. And part of me resisted because I thought, I can't do that. Women don't do that. And here I was the one who had told my pastor I wanted to do that. He said, you have gifts for ministry. You need to go to seminary. None of my friends, none of my women friends were applying to seminary, so I did it very quietly. I had a lot of men friends who were doing that. They were the pre-seminary guys, and they were all about that, and they told us they were going, and they were going to get in, and I just didn't tell anyone. And I got accepted. And I told people, and they were shocked that I was going to go to seminary. Even though I had been singing in this Lutheran Youth Encounter team, I had been a religion major, was an RA, I was listening to people and helping people. I guess it just was out of their concept zone. But I went to Luther Seminary in St. Paul. As I said, I'm very Lutheran to the max. And my first day of seminary, in the Christian education class, I was sitting there, and there were about 25 students, two levels of chairs, and there was an upper level behind me. and there were three women sitting in the class, and the man behind me, as he listened to the professor, said, "Why are all these women here in class?" And we just froze. We didn't know what to say. I had no idea that we would be confronted, and there were only 20 women at Luther Seminary of 200 students, barely 10% of the incoming class. So the professor, who was very nice and kind, said, "Well, I think we should hear from the women." And there was just dead silence. And I'm thinking, oh, crud. Well, I should say something. And I thought maybe the others would, but I just blurted out something. I said, "Well, I think that maybe the Apostle Paul was writing from a context, and maybe we should study that. I'm sure we'll learn about that while we're in seminary. And I think that it would be good for us to know what the original Greek said." And the professor said, "That's a great answer, and that's exactly what we're going to do." But I was so traumatized by this experience, and it might seem odd to folks sitting there, but when women we're accosted about our very being and our existence, and how dare you be at this place where you're not supposed to be here, it's a frightening thing. So I went back and got my Bible, and I read everything in the New Testament, the Greek Testament, and underlined everything about women, about how Jesus walked with women, the women who were around him, the women who walked and worked with St. Paul, all the women who were part of the early church. And I was excited and delighted, and I was angry. And I was angry that no one told me about these women who were part of the founding of the Christian faith. So I graduated from seminary, and I got ordained, and I've been a pastor for almost 30 years, and I have lots of interesting stories. Some of them are fun and exciting and thrilling, and some of them are devastatingly sad about what it means to be a woman and a faith tradition that really doesn't sometimes welcome women. So I'll just pause there, and I'm going to let my friend Maren take it away.
Yeah. I come from Somalia, and I born and raised in Somalia, and I remember that when I was young in Somalia, especially West Africa, except the North Africa, it is Arabian, and there was custom, tradition where women to wear a hijab, this called hijab. So when I was growing up in Somalia, it wasn't exist. I never see anyone wearing hijab. We was just to like influence Italian colonized, and there was a big Catholic. There was no other sect of Christianity. Only Catholic was a big church, because Italian was the south, and also the place, the area where I come from was lived like American. They used to have a special place, huge. Different than other Europeans, like Germany or Italians. So I didn't know if they had their own church different, but it was only big, famous. And then they teach you about the religion. I never heard about the verse that talk about the hijab. So we was just like Western, mixing men, women, shaking, just like normal as a Western. So the school was sitting each other, and education was very good, because it was under the Italian, you know. Mm-hmm. So they teach you in Islamically, like Jewish people, even though I never see the temple, they teach you like that we have similarity. They believe only one God, they don't eat pork, they don't drink, they have modesty, blah, blah, blah. And then they tell you, like Christians, you can't pray their church. Mm-hmm. If you want to pray for the Jewish people, because they don't have a statue. But Christians, they have a statue. And that is that forbidden to worship, mm-hmm. accepting that creator. Mm-hmm. So I grew up that, you know, like, I respect the Christians. They're all in Mogadishu, everywhere, you know, Germany, Europeans, any kind. They was all Christian. But I never see Jewish people. Maybe in my area, they never lived. So when happened war, and then I came to here in America 2002. I had a background of, as I told you, like we had a European. So my dad, he used to send us private schools if you want to learn German language or Italian or English, whatever you want. So I had a different language. I have education. But when I came here in America, I thought it was only me. But even Europeans, if they come here, your knowledge does not exist. You have to start all over zero because I didn't know English. And they act like that you're stupid, you don't know anything if you don't know English. They don't see that you have another knowledge, another degree, another language. While it's only, they know only English, some of them know Spanish. But in Europeans, they know two languages. If you're France, you have to learn English. If you're English, you have to learn France. If you go to Germany, you have to know English. Mm-hmm. They are, you know, multilingual. But when I came here, I didn't wear a hijab. I still have kind of stylish like Europeans, Western. I didn't believe to wear even. I used to tell, oh, why are they wearing, you know? Mm-hmm. But when I come here, I become more Muslim than before. Mm-hmm. Because when you come here, you see in the media, everybody attacking you, asking you many questions, silly questions. The question that you said, it's mm-hmm. impossible to ask like human being these questions. Mm-hmm. I've been through a lot that some people even ask you, do you have a bump in your, you know, under your hijab? And, you know, you don't know where it's come from, that question. And a lot of discrimination. And the problem is I come directly to St. Cloud, where I didn't go any other place in America. And I come here, I start ESL, ABC, up to in I come college and graduate. But in St. Cloud, where I come, I get good people. I didn't have a family, so I went to the Catholic Church because I know the Catholic Church was in Somalia, so I asked that if I can have shelter where to live. So they took me different houses. I went to one woman, and she had a statue big, you know, like Mary, huge, big. And then she says, yeah. And then she says that, are you a Christian? I said, no. Then she said, she's not welcome my home. And then the guy, his name Alan J. Chris, he's still like my father. I still, up to today, I call the Father's Day, I send something. I feel like, and he was a Christian, but he, you know, it's the different type of people. Any community, they are bad and good. So he said, I'm sorry, Mayran, you're not Christian, let's go. And then we went to another house, mm-hmm. and the same things. Finally, I found a woman. She's 82 years old, alone, and then she was Lutheran, mm-hmm. background in Norwegian. She hugged me, and she says, welcome, you wanna be my daughter? My grandchild. I said yes, and then I lived with her. Her house. She used to help me homework. In the morning, she had a van. She tried to, and she said no. She said, "Don't take us." And she used to take me in the school, and I used to clean and give my food. But funny things was we don't drink alcohol. So she used to drink like apple, red apple, and I used to think that she's drinking alcohol. So when I see the cup, I used to run in my room because I thought maybe they violence if they drink. And
tell them her name, because I
can't. Her name was Dorothea Lovett.
Yeah, Dorothea,
right. Okay. And she was my best friend. I used to cry with her, laugh with her. One time I have a man, the bus driver. It was snow, and I wanna stop for, you know, the bus. So he said, you not belong to this area. And I didn't know many English to protect myself and say, no, stop. I said, stop, stop. Because the area, St. Cloud, is the kind of people are wealthy. So he drove, and then I came back all the way to the station. I didn't have a cell phone. Mm-hmm. And then I took another bus, and then I tell the grandma. In the morning, she said, let's go. And we went there, and she defended me, and you know, and she said, show me, point, which one? So she wanted almost, you know. So she was so lovely, and she died in 2009. I was there when she died, and I shared with her pain, and it was like my grandmother. I was a Muslim, she was a Christian, but we have a great bond. When I came to St. Cloud also, I have worked a shelter, a women's shelter. And I had an experience that the women is, I share with their pains. We are all women, no matter what. And there is also some women that discriminated me, attacking me, my hijab, and why I'm wearing, Muslim women oppressed, and all of that. Some of them I educated because I believe that Muhammad was a mercy on women. He's the number one human being give right 1,400 years ago. Mm-hmm. Because before Islam, women don't have a right. Mm-hmm. Infant's child was a buried alive because she's a woman. And orphans didn't have a right. Widows doesn't have a right. And women was a property of man. But if you can't say 10 minutes to educate a person about Islam, mm-hmm. people have to know. And the Quran talks about chapter of women, talks about chapter of Mary. There is no even Bible talk about a Mary, and she's honorable and the mother of Jesus. And you can't find one whole chapter, but you can find in Quran. Quran talks about Moses, Abraham, all the faiths. We are similarity. We don't have to look our differences. That's how I believe. And we are women. And majority in religions, they say beautiful about equality in men and women. But a man dominating any culture, any religion, mm-hmm. always been there oppressing women, but has nothing to do with religions.
I guess if we can continue to kind of have a discussion, or if you have questions, I think all of us are very happy to answer questions. And one of the things that you were just saying that reminded me too is that it's not just that people ask questions or that they should know about these things, but they have to want to know and they have to listen. And I think you're right, having a conversation between women and sharing, because there is that common thread of being a woman. Mm-hmm. And any woman, regardless of what your faith community is, your ethnic or racial background, will have something to share, or can certainly feel that pain, or to know that you're always looking over your shoulder, because women in any society, there's still always that risk, right? And we know that certainly as women, we need to be supportive of one another. Anybody have any questions?
We'll
keep talking. Well, one of the things I just want to talk, because I realized I didn't talk about looking a little bit at the role of women in Judaism, and there's a variety of different roles, and I think what probably Islam and Judaism have most in common, one of the things, is that it's hard to figure out what box you check. So when people ask about race and ethnicity, and people ask me what that is, it doesn't really fall into a convenient little box on there. And so I will usually always say that I'm Jewish. To me, that's my ethnic background. It's my faith mm-hmm. background. It's so much a part of me. It's not something that I can always pull out and be distinctive about, and particularly being a woman. And I think Judaism, similarly to Islam, has a reputation of being very marginalizing to women, right? That women, what roles do women play? It wasn't until I was in, I think, elementary or junior high that the first woman was ordained mm-hmm. as a Reformed rabbi. Women can still not be ordained as rabbis in Orthodox tradition. They can in conservative, and Judaism is generally broadly categorized into those three areas. Most Jews in the United States are Reformed, so women have a stronger role. But even in Orthodox Judaism, women are having a stronger and stronger role, just as you were talking about, mm-hmm. oftentimes because there may not be anybody else there mm-hmm. to do that. So do you have nothing at all? Or do you say, all right, you know, we can let the women can do some things. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be a rabbi when I was younger. It was something I certainly considered, not for singing, as we know. I could never be a cantor. those things, you know, not because just skill-wise, but I think there's no reason why women can look and define for themselves sometimes what their role is going to be mm-hmm. and what they're going to do in their faith community if there doesn't seem to be something there for you. Sometimes mm-hmm. you have to create it, just as you did mm-hmm. yourself, and maybe then opening up a path for other girls and women.
Mm-hmm. The Lutheran tradition of which I travel in began ordaining women, accepting the gifts and celebrating the gifts of women in ordained ministry in 1970. And prior to that, women could not be ordained in that part of the Lutheran tradition. There are still two parts or several parts of the Lutheran communion that don't ordain women in the United States, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and the Wisconsin Lutheran Synod, and then parts of the World Lutheran Communion. Since women have been ordained in the ELCA, it's become something that's been life-changing, especially to some of the men who at first resisted, but now say, we can't imagine a church without ordained women because women bring these amazing gifts in ministry. They're not always the same that we have, or they bring a different perspective, a different voice. They've heralded and lifted up ministries with children and women's concerns that the men said, we just didn't know anything about, or we just, you know, we knew about it, but it wasn't so prominent. Yes.
I was just going to ask, do you guys think or believe that religion takes away from faith? Because what she shared earlier and what I heard all you guys say, I'm a Christian myself, but I have friends with different religions. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's like our faith has so many similarities, but what pulls people apart is religion.
Within the religions, like different rules that are set down in the different faith traditions, those kind of things?
Yeah.
I think so. And I think there are human-created traditions that aren't necessarily bound in the holy books, but they're imposed on faith communities. Certainly we could talk about that at length, but I believe that there are some human creations and contrivances that really, that we have been struggling against. I mean, certainly women have in all faith traditions to try and stand equally with men as partners in a faith tradition.
Well, and I think a lot of it is open for interpretation, mm-hmm. right? And people can read the same passage in whatever religious or faith, you know, community, and kind of use those words because there's a difference between spirituality and religion. Mm-hmm. They don't have to be mutually exclusive, but for a lot of people feel very spiritual, but may not like the confines of religion. It always seems to me to be the antithesis for faith communities to be fighting amongst each other, either I'm the best, you're the best, you don't do this, you don't do that. That seems to go against anything I know about any religion. When you look at the tenets of Islam, when you look at the tenets, I'm just talking about the basic tenets of Christianity, the basic tenets of Judaism, that goes against everything that they're about. So I think you're right that these are things that have become more modern nuances and interpretations. Somehow it's sort of like the Olympics, we're number one, and if you're not, that means somebody has to be number two or number three or number four. It shouldn't be a competition, right? People should be reaching across to each other to help each other rather than to try to sway people or do anything like that.
Yeah, I want to add to, like, I think so that it makes us unique. That's why we have different color, different culture, and different religion. I wish that all the world we will be one color and one religion, but it's not going to happen. And we have to accept, I believe faith is very important because human being, they hang to the faith. If you don't have no law, no faith, it will be like animals. And also go back to my topic, it's the gender role of Muslim women. It's like they had scholars 1400 years ago. Mm-hmm. And without women, I didn't know my rights. It's the prophet, his wife, is they the one talk about it, how to men treat women, how, you know, the rights we have. And Muslim women, if she work, she keep her money. Man, he's the one protector. He have to take care of us. He have to provide in us. And that is the unique, different other religions. Because that why that a man and women in Islam are not equal. Because it's not like that I'm saying they not have equal, but the difference is that the man cannot bear a child. He can become a feeding or nursing or nurturing a baby. And women also have different responsibility. Mm-hmm. different during men also have different, and I think so every religion is a beautiful. I'm not against any religion, except that nobody, if somebody forced me to take, you know, like crusade, come to the Christian, then I will fight and defend myself. But if everybody keep their own religion, it's good, because even the Quran of the Fair says, mm-hmm. keep your religion, I will keep my religion, and then we respect one another. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, we just have somebody right behind you ask a question. Yeah.
We have until 10 till, so I don't know if you want to make a summary statement or answer the question.
I think maybe let the person ask a question.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you're Jewish, you're Christian, and you've all established that you have a lot of similarities. But what I don't understand here is, as a Jewish believer and a Christian, you all have a certain modest way that the woman should dress, like sort of like a nun. And for you, like, you guys are, I've seen pictures like where you're almost wearing garments similar to what Muslims and nuns wear. And all three, they wear similar garments and they cover their hair. Mm-hmm. But when the Muslim woman of today, when the Muslim woman goes out of the way as a refugee of this land and decides to express it in you, it's by choice that you wear that garment. And if you don't, you don't get punished for it, neither do we. Because I am currently wearing pants, but I'm wearing a headscarf, but I'm contradicting, you know? But it's just the way I'm going on about expressing it. The fact that I don't understand why the society looks specifically at the Muslim woman as being oppressed and like, mm-hmm. makes that like an issue, when really all three of you have similar garments that you wear, but just you guys decide to do it.
Sexism and racism and anti-Islamic perspective.
I think it's xenophobia. Mm-hmm. It's that I think, especially if you look at in Minnesota, let's say in St. Cloud, is that I think what becomes more visual for people, if you went to New York, if you went to Los Angeles, if you went to Chicago, if you went to the Twin Cities, and you'd be in a certain area, and you see both men and women who are primarily Orthodox Jews, their clothing would be very distinctive, and they would not be looking like everybody else, because that's part of the tenets of certain things that people wear and don't wear. Just as people might be Muslim and might wear certain things or not, depending on where they live, and would consider themselves still to be as faithful or fervent believer in Islam, and the same thing in looking at women who are Christian and looking at very modest attire. If for Orthodox Jewish women, they do not show their hair, right? Either you have it covered with a wig, or you have it covered in somehow, and looking at that modesty. So there are a lot of different things, and I agree with you completely. I think a lot of it has to do with xenophobia, and that so people becoming aware of more Muslims are not Muslims who were initially, but who was, right, born in the United States. In my family, my mother's the first one in her family born in the U.S. But people forget that, and when you see everything that's going on, I think it is a way of polarizing, of trying to polarize people, and it becomes very political, mm-hmm. it is sexist, it's xenophobic, it's, you know, all of those different things, and it just shouldn't be. People should be able to express themselves, and it should not be seen as better, worse. It's just maybe different, and that's fine. But, yeah.
So you're sharing.
And I just want to say, I knew the time would go so fast on this 50-minute panel. Are you able to stay if you want to come up and talk?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And we could probably close with a greeting of peace, and so with from yours.
Shalom.
Salam.
And peace be with you. So thanks for coming.
Yes, thank you.